I'm very pleased to have with me this week Joseph Ellis, the author of His Excellency, George Washington. Some of you longtime listeners to Talking History might recall that Joe Ellis was on our show the week of February 18th, 2001, and we discussed his book, Founding Brothers, for which he won a Pulitzer Prize. Today, we'll be discussing his already highly acclaimed new biography of George Washington. Welcome back, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. We have to start off with the obvious question. With the surge of new books on the Founding Fathers, and maybe it's not a surge, it almost seems to be a continual flow of new books on the Founding Fathers, to which you've contributed many volumes. How would you explain this interest? We just can't seem to satisfy the market.
It's a good question, and I've tried not to think too much about it because I'm one of the major beneficiaries of it, and I'm afraid I might analyze it into non-existence. Part of it is that the papers of these folks are now reaching culmination, started in the middle of the century in many cases, and now you've got a mass of material available that didn't exist before. Part of it is, I think, that programs like this one, NPR programs, C-SPAN programs, give authors writing books of this sort a venue that they didn't have before. And part of it is a hunger for political leadership that we don't think we have now. Part of it is a kind of once upon a time, presidents wrote their own speeches and were intellectually impressive. When I was on the book tour for Founding Brothers, the question I got, how come in 2000 we have to choose between Gore and Bush, and in the year 1800 we got to choose between Adams and Jefferson? So there's this sense that the political culture we've created up here in the 20th and 21st century isn't delivering the same quality of character that it once did.
And do you think that's fair? Can we look at—
It's not really fair, because being present at the creation confers a huge advantage. That said, I do think that looking back at that generation of political leaders, which I think is the most impressive group of political leaders we've ever had, it does cause you to wonder if there's any way for us to make some changes in the way we elect people and the way we restrict or don't restrict campaigns and campaign finances. It makes you think that there is talent out there in the American society that ought to rise to the top in public life.
Okay. So why George Washington, other than you hadn't done him yet?
Good question. I sort of walked around him a lot, you know, I mean, in other books. And he's like, as I said in the book, he's like the man in the moon. He's always there, but, you know, he's far away. I think he's the toughest nut to crack. I think that he's tougher to write about than Jefferson or Adams especially. His diaries are not revealing. They're about the weather. And when he talks about which way the wind is blowing, he's not being metaphorical. Yet he is a central figure in American history. I would say he's the most famous figure in American history about whom most educated Americans know almost nothing. I mean, they did a survey at Mount Vernon, and high school kids, only 1 out of 10 knew that George Washington was a Revolutionary War hero.
How much of that comes from our seeming desire to have these people be perfect? And maybe the less we know, the more saintly they become.
I believe you're right on that. And one of the distinguishing features, I think, of my own work is I'm writing about flawed founders. I think that there's kind of an electromagnetic field around the founders, and they carry it to one extreme or the other. They're the greatest figures and heroes of all time, iconographic kind of creatures, or they're the deadest, whitest males in American history, responsible for classism, imperialism, patriarchy, racism, and everything else. I think those are juvenile attitudes. I think we want to get a more adult, mature look at these people who are hardly perfect, but taken together, nevertheless, are the greatest collection of political leaders we've ever had.
Right, and that's the great strength of your book. You really do peel away the myth and get at the man. But let me take you to an early stage in his life. You write in your book that you felt the French and Indian War was an important moment in his life in shaping his personality.
Right. When Adams goes to Harvard and Jefferson goes to William and Mary, Washington goes to war. War is his education, his curriculum. And he learns some hard lessons. I mean, he becomes a hard-boiled realist. Any sentimental emotions he might have had are sort of weaned away from him. You know, he really does survive several battles that, by all rights, he shouldn't have. There's a sense of destiny about him, even as a young man, and people start writing about him in that regard. It's the crucible in which the foundation of his personality takes shape, I think. Not that it's complete. You know, he grows and changes. And it's one of the interesting and impressive things about him. He learns from his experience. But I think that the emotional foundation for the mature man is laid there in his 20s during the French and Indian War.
Okay. Interesting you use the word crucible, because that's the title of the documentary that's currently showing on the French and Indian War.
It's based on the book by Fred Anderson.
Right.
That's a really good book.
Right, it is. Well, let me take you to the American Revolution, because you make another interesting point there by setting him apart from the others in terms of how he arrived at his decision to seek independence or separation from Great Britain.
Yeah, he doesn't think about the coming of the revolution in the same way that Adams and Jefferson do. They think politically and they think constitutionally. They think in terms of Parliament, in terms of Parliament's right to legislate and tax, or their lack of that right. Washington thinks in more primal terms. First of all, the face of the British Empire for him is his merchant friend in London, William Carey. He thinks he's being cheated by Carey. He's trapped in some kind of, he thinks, conspiracy on the part of Carey. Also, he owns about 50,000 acres west of the Alleghenies, and in the proclamation of 1763, George III says that all that land is an Indian reservation and nobody can own it out there. You know, he thinks that's his land, and it's been taken away from him by this guy, George III. Washington becomes pretty clear by the late 1760s that he thinks that unless Britain changes its course, we're headed towards war.
Interesting. Well, during the American Revolution, he becomes general, and that obviously piques his reputation. And we tend to look at him as a great military leader. But in fact, as you point out, he lost more battles than he won. But nevertheless, we won. So,
of all the successful generals, he lost more battles. He's just the opposite of Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee won all the battles and lost the war. So did Napoleon, for that matter, until he meets his Waterloo. He's not a good tactician. He's outgeneraled by Howe on several occasions. But he eventually has the key insight. It's simple, but in retrospect, only in retrospect. Namely, he doesn't have to win the war. The British have to win the war. And in some sense, Brian, he's leading an insurgency. He's leading an army, but an insurgency. And the occupying power, even though it's a powerful, Britain is the most powerful military nation in the world, it's going to have a very difficult time sustaining control over this larger population and landmass.
Right.
And he knows that. In the end, we don't win the war. They just give up.
Right. It gets replayed in history several times.
Yes.
You know, one of the good things that I really enjoy about the book here is how you set something up and then you either correct it or pose a different idea. Same thing happens when you get to Valley Forge. You acknowledge it's an important turning point and you handled it well, but then you turn around and say what may have even been more important is his decision to inoculate the entire army against smallpox.
Right. He does that early on. And the casualties in the war on both sides, more people died of smallpox than died in combat. Washington is immune to smallpox. He had it as a young man in Barbados. Now, some people say he was immune to everything. But the decision to inoculate the Continental Army and to insist upon that probably is as big as any other military decision he made.
Along the same line, you talk again a little bit about slavery, and most of us, when we think of slavery and the Founding Fathers, think of Jefferson and his agonizing over his ownership of slaves and whatever. And here's Washington, who's not noted for writing anything at length, especially on slaves, but he frees his slaves.
Right, in his will. He frees his slaves, the ones he owns at Mount Vernon. There are 319 slaves when Washington's an old man, and it's interesting. Of the 319 slaves, he estimates at any time only 100 of them can work. Others are too young, too old, or too sick. So part of his motive is economic.
Huh.
He's losing money. Part of his motive is his own reputation. There's a lot of Quakers who have been saying to him, this is the one stain, and this is the thing that you need to correct before you die. He cares terribly about posterity. He knows that we'd be sitting here in this studio 200 years later. And that he needed to get this one right. And he thinks slavery's wrong.
Right.
He thinks slavery's incompatible with the values of the revolution. It doesn't start out that way, but he changes his mind during the course of the war, under the influence of young guys like Hamilton and Henry Lawrence and Lafayette. And so he grows on this issue. He's just the opposite of Jefferson. Jefferson starts out believing in emancipation and by the end of his life argues for the spread of slavery into Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Washington starts out as a pretty typical planter talking about his slaves as livestock and ends up saying that slavery is incompatible with the values of the revolution and I must free my own slaves. He's the only major Virginia public figure to do that.
What was behind his decision to wait until he died?
He's a control freak. He doesn't want to give up what he's acquired. And he's not to the manor born. You know, he's really sort of marries his way into the hierarchy of Virginia society. And there's a law, too, that says that if you free your slaves in Virginia, they have to leave the state within a year. And the slaves at Mount Vernon II are intermarried. The dower slaves owned by his wife, Martha, who officially Washington doesn't own, mm-hmm. are intermarried with the other slaves. And so if you free one of them, what happens to the families?
Yeah. It's interesting as we proceed here. Before I started reading this book, I, like many people, if you asked me what Washington thought about much of anything, I probably couldn't have answered, because we never study in the traditional text Washington's thinking about mm-hmm. anything. If anything, we're looking at someone who presides over Adams on one side of the table and Jefferson on the other and tries to make a Solomon-like decision. But once again, I'm surprised here's a man who gave a lot of thought to Native Americans.
Absolutely.
So tell us about that.
Well, you know, as a young man, he encountered Native Americans in their fiercest form, and he respected them. In fact, in several instances, he said, if I was in their situation, I'd be doing the same thing they are, trying to protect their own property. It's not property for them, but their own homes. During the first term of his presidency, Washington devotes more time to the Native American issue than anything else. And he wants to avoid Indian removal. He wants to prevent the elimination of an Indian population east of the Mississippi. He wants to create a series of enclaves and homelands that will be protected by federal law and that will be regarded as foreign countries. He said that the Indian ambassadors that are coming from the Shawnee tribe or the Creek tribe are more important than the ambassadors from Britain and France, because the future of America is out here.
Interesting.
And it fails because the states won't let it happen. And it would also have required a military force to protect them that was unaffordable. But okay. That's what he wanted.
Okay. We don't like to see our heroes as ambitious people. Mm. We tend to like to see them as anything but, who happen to get maybe dragged into or encouraged to get involved in something and they're successful. Yet you make the point that Washington was very ambitious.
Adam said that we always selected Washington because he was always the tallest man in the room. But he was also the most ambitious man in the room. He was very avaricious about land. If you were a squatter that sat on some of his land, he'd sue you to death. He was a man who really wanted power, but he knew how to surrender power. His ability to walk away from power was but he did that because he knew in the end that would make him even more powerful.
Right.
And it did.
Right. Very good. Again, it might come as a surprise to people that Washington was not deified in office, did not leave office on a cloud or as a saint. He had his critics when he left office.
He did. His first term was pretty much a cakewalk and a yeah. hallelujah. But his second term was riddled with controversy, mostly because of different attitudes towards France and the French Revolution. But there's a magazine called The Aurora that opens fire on Washington in his second term. And Tom Paine actually comes back from France and says that we devoutly pray for Washington's death. Imminent death, and he's a traitor to the American Revolution. Washington doesn't understand the party warfare that's breaking out in the middle of the 1790s. He doesn't believe in parties. Nobody really believes in parties.
Right.
Jefferson says, if I must go to heaven in a party, I prefer not to go at all. But they're creating them nonetheless, and it creates a kind of bickering and a kind of combustible infighting that Washington wants to levitate above. He doesn't see himself as the leader of a party. But that's what he's become, the Federalist Party.
Okay. We only have a couple minutes left, so let me ask you to think beyond Washington a bit here, because you have really kind of associated the various founding fathers with characteristics. Franklin, you said, was probably the wisest, Hamilton the most brilliant, Adams the best read, Jefferson the most intellectually sophisticated. But you say all of them would have acknowledged Washington to be their superior. You still associate all those characteristics with the founding fathers, and why would they defer to Washington as a leader?
I still do believe it. Mm-hmm. I began writing the book with that question in mind. Why? In some sense, the whole book is an answer. It's leadership. It's judgment. There are so many things that if he had gotten it wrong, we wouldn't be here. But it is a quality of judgment that is basic and elemental. It's not fine spun. Jefferson's very fine spun.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the decision to go lead the Continental Army against the greatest military power in the world and to bet his life on that commitment, he turns out to be right again. Mm-hmm. To come out of retirement and chair the Constitutional Convention, thereby legitimizing a meeting, a convention that others were calling a kind of coup d'etat, illegal, illegitimate. And then he shapes the American presidency. If you read the Constitution, it doesn't say very much about what the president can do. It tells us how he can elect him. But the modern presidency is a creation of Washington. So he really is first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. And that last thing is really important because Americans didn't think of themselves as part of a coherent nation. They thought of themselves as New Englanders or Virginians. And Washington is the one figure who symbolizes the nation, and everybody can agree he is America. He is the United States. Remember, when they talk about the United States back in the 18th century, they didn't say the United States is. They said the United States are.
Right.
And he's the person that makes the plural into a singular.
Great. That's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks for joining us, Joe. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure, Brian.
Good to have you here. And congratulations on your book. I've been speaking with the award-winning author and historian Joseph Ellis, the author of His Excellency, George Washington, published by Vintage Books.